If you ever feel pressed for time or short on cash, you're familiar with the concept of scarcity. But our next guest says there's a lot you may not know about how running short on time or money can affect the way we think and make decisions.
Eldar Shafir joins us now. He's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we usually think of being short on time and short on money as very different things, but your book starts with a realization about the similarities between being crunched for time, crunched for money. How are they similar?
Well, if you think about it, even intuitively and certainly in the research we've done, it turns out that when you feel a lack of time or money, you spend a lot of time focusing on it. You spend a lot of time juggling the thing you don't have enough of. And as it turns out, when you spend a lot of bandwidth, a lot of attention to that topic, you have less mind left for other things in your life.
It makes sense that we juggle the thing we're worried about, but our brains, for some reason, it sounds like, take it to an extreme. Why do we have that hyper-tunnel-style focus on that?
Well, it sort of comes almost automatically. You know, what's interesting if you look at behavioral work is that, you know, we don't have full control about how our brains process information. You know, we walk around like the proud owners of this machine and we think we know what it's doing and that we can control it. But the fact is, you know, we don't really understand or control it any better than we do our liver. And so our brain basically focuses on this thing that's disturbing us, focuses on the thing we're feeling threatened by or preoccupied with. Often, what we call in the book tunneling, often leads us to focus on it excessively and sort of lose sight of the periphery.
So what is going on with our decision-making when we are in this time crunch or when we're realizing that we're short for cash or whatever other resource we're short on?
Well, we focus on it. We do the best we can. As it turns out, if we look, for example, at poverty and those who are experiencing money scarcity, they do very well managing the moment-to-moment exigencies, emergencies that come up, but they pay a price of neglecting things in the periphery. You know, there's a fire, there's a bucket of water next to you. You don't spend too much time inquiring how much that bucket of water is going to cost. You pour it on the fire. You take a payday loan, which ends up being at massively high interest. Right now, it solves the problem fairly well. And then it turns out a week or two from now, you owe more money than you can afford and you enter a poverty trap of a sort.
So these short-term decisions we make under the stress of that scarcity may not be in our long-term best interest. Is that a pretty common theme that you found studying scarcity?
Indeed, it is. It's often the case, you know, you focus and you neglect the consequences that emerge later and the peripheral decisions that to some extent you've neglected. Often the very act of focusing basically diminishes the quality of your decision because the brain is so preoccupied with it. So, for example, another form of scarcity we discuss is loneliness, you know, the scarcity of social connections. Interestingly, it turns out that some people who experience extreme loneliness, who are concerned with, you know, making connections and friends, when they're not thinking about it, our research shows are socially very appropriate, adequate, just as good as anybody else. But once loneliness impinges on their thinking, once they're focusing on loneliness, they do less well. So interestingly, when they meet somebody and the issue of social connections emerges as very topical in their heads and occupies their attention, at that very moment when they meet somebody, they function less well. Too much of their attention is devoted to the topic. They stop responding well. They don't engage well. They don't tell jokes at the right moment, and they end up being less adequate than they would have been otherwise, which further hurts their ability to socialize well.
So their focus on loneliness makes them ultimately more lonely because of that chain of decisions.
Indeed. It just takes mental bandwidth and leaves less for functioning well at that moment.
Well, it sounds like there's a core scarcity here, and it's that mental bandwidth you're talking about. Is our brain capacity that finite that if we focus on one important thing, we really lose that much of everything else?
Exactly. In other words, you know, we have, you know, the brain has different compartments. There is a long-term memory, the things that, you know, birthday dates that you know, phone numbers you know, that's, you know, massive capacity. But working memory, the part that you juggle in real time, the things you attend to, that's very limited, much more than we appreciate. So if you've seen recent work, for example, on the use of cell phones and cars, you know, it turns out that we think we can have no problem dividing our attention, multitasking, and basically it turns out that multitasking is just another word for not paying attention. And that, you know, using a cell phone in the car is basically equivalent in terms of your reaction times and your ability to attend. It's roughly equivalent to being legally drunk. And so, you know, our capacity is in fact very limited. Cognitive psychologists for, you know, 3 decades now have done very simple manipulations where I give you either a 7-digit number to keep in your head to remember, or a 2-digit number. And when you keep a 7-digit number in your head, try not to forget it, you do less well elsewhere. You're even more likely to eat a brownie as opposed to a piece of fruit when you walk down a room because you're less attending to what it is that you should or shouldn't eat, and you just perform less well elsewhere.
I hate to use computer metaphors for the brain, but it seems like it's apt here. My computer can hold lots of data that I'm not accessing right now, but if I start running too many applications, too many programs, it starts to slow down.
You sound like you read a chapter of our book.
I read a little more than that, I'll be honest.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the metaphors we use, exactly. Or, you know, think of an air traffic controller. You're keeping many planes in the air, and all of a sudden one of them has got major trouble, and you focus on that heavily, which is not a bad thing to do. In fact, it's the right thing to do to some extent. But then you neglect other planes in the air, and that could lead to great difficulties.
You mentioned that brownie a minute ago, which reminded me of another of the things that's a scarcity, that's a finite quantity, self-control. You write about that a little bit. And that's not something I usually tend to think of as a resource, like I might think of money or I might think of time. How is self-control a scarce object?
Well, the way it relates to scarcity, again, has to do with the attention you're able to pay. So imagine that, you know, I'm trying to cut down on my consumption of bread. You know, I'd rather not eat bread. And we go to a restaurant for lunch, you and I, and we have a very intense and interesting conversation. And somebody leaves bread on the table, and I eat it. I eat it not because I looked at the bread and said, I don't want to eat it, but I can't resist. I eat it because I didn't even notice it. Now, I look like somebody who failed to exercise self-control because I'm not intending to be a bread eater. But in fact, to a large extent, I failed to resist not because of weakness of will, but because of lack of attention. And so a lot of cases that look like weakness of will basically have to do with people's behavior that comes sort of from acting automatically without enough cognitive control to impose on where it is that you pay your attention and how you choose.
And then if my life's going swimmingly and my attention isn't occupied, my bandwidth isn't getting eaten up, I might have more to devote for self-control and no brownie for me. But I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of stress eating. Is that the explanation?
You know, there's other things going on, of course, but that's a massive contributor, basically. You know, the other thing is, you know, all of us have a lot of concerns, a lot of preoccupations, but what's interesting is in many cases, like you and I have many major concerns in our lives, but most of them can wait. So, you know, when we're having a half-hour conversation on the phone or on the radio, we decide to leave our preoccupations for later this afternoon. But when something's impinging on your attention heavily, like, you know, the preoccupation of how to pay rent at the end of this month or not having any friends or things of that sort, sometimes it's hard to control, so that they impinge on your performance even in moments when you'd rather focus on something else. So that's the kind of things that we come up, you know, in the studies we conduct, where we simply show that the poor perform less well even when they try to take tests that we give them.
And if the money is looking better for that poor person and they've got their rent in hand, they might perform better on the same test?
That's the kind of studies we do. So, you know, we go to the mall, we get people to participate in the study, we give them classic cognitive tests that gauge your ability to control your attention, your cognitive control, as well as fluid intelligence. It's a major component of IQ. And we give them these tests, and in the background, we present them with a financial scenario, a hypothetical financial scenario, so your car breaks down. And that scenario comes in two versions. Some of them get a manageable version, where the car is going to cost $150 to fix, which we know most of them can do. And the other comes at $1,500 to fix, which we know that for many people in the mall presents a serious challenge. And we get household income, so we know, we divide them by splitting them in half into rich and poor. And if you look at what they do, the rich people in the mall, when they perform these tests with a background of either the easy-to-fix car or the more challenging car, they do equally well on these tests. It doesn't really matter. The poor people in the mall, and by that I mean they're not, you know, objectively poor, they're just lower income, when they are concerned with fixing the cheaper car, they do exactly as well as the rich. They perform equally well on IQ and cognitive control tests. But when they're preoccupied with a more difficult car to manage, with a more expensive car, they now perform significantly less well. Their cognitive control is lower, self-control, managing resources is lower, and their IQ is something like the equivalent of 13 IQ points lower when they're preoccupied by a more expensive car.
Is it the same for someone who has money and is okay on money but is intentionally being frugal and weighing each financial decision? Is that the same as somebody who doesn't have enough money and is weighing each of those decisions?
That's a beautiful question. You know, there's probably going to be individual differences. In most cases, frugality is a discretionary thing. You know, you choose to be frugal, and in moments when things interfere or impose themselves on you, you have the option to be less frugal for a day or two. You know, when we diet, there's a lot of data on how diet imposes a major cognitive load on us. you know, it takes a lot of our attention. And if you have a very important exam to prepare or things to do, you just stop dieting for 2 or 3 days and go back to it. Of course, what happens with genuine poverty as opposed to frugality is that, you know, you don't have that option to say, no, this week I won't be poor, I'll go back to it next week. And so in that sense, it imposes itself on a very different level that's not discretionary and, you know, it's quite stressful.
What I want to start talking about what we can learn from this. What can we say change in an anti-poverty program that might recognize some of the things you're talking about?
Right. So first of all, a footnote that's good to keep in mind. You know, when you think about the studies we did in the mall, as well as Indian farmers and many others, you know, these are not people in abject poverty. So when we look at the people we encounter in the mall who would divide into rich and poor, these are people who are not poor, they're just budget constrained. They're people who, once you present these issues, impose on their minds because they're budgeting carefully and not easily managing to finish the month. So this is, you know, 100 million Americans, maybe 150 million Americans and growing. So this is a major segment of the population. Now, what to do? You know, the general lesson from this is that we have to be much more preoccupied by bandwidth. We have to be preoccupied by the imposition that we put on people's attention and the demands we put on their cognitive capacity when we run programs and do things of that sort. When you give people automatic deposits, automatic payments, when you schedule their income at regular dates as opposed to unpredictable dates, when their working hours are predictable from day to day and from week to week, so as opposed to, you know, the discovering the day before what hours I work tomorrow and have to worry about arranging childcare, anything you do to facilitate bandwidth, notice what happens. It facilitates bandwidth all throughout their lives. You know, it's the same limited bandwidth that we have in this machinery behind the eyes and between the ears that serves us for everything we do. It's a bandwidth we use to remember to take our medications on time, to exercise restraint and control with our children, to do our budgeting. It's all the same bandwidth. So once you liberate some bandwidth for me, once you make my parts of my everyday life more manageable, less threatening, you have now allowed me to be a better parent, to take my medication on time more often.
We're talking to Eldar Shafir about his new book, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, and we'll pick up what we can do with this information after the news.
And we want to hear from you. Was it hard for you to get out of the mindset of scarcity, be it for money or time or self-control? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time. It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Eldar Shafir is with us. He's the co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. The story so far being low on resources, things like time and money or social connections. It changes the way we think, oftentimes not for the better.
You can join the conversation with your questions and your experiences. How does being short on time or money affect you? And do you think you make better decisions or worse decisions when you're in a crunch? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on our Facebook page. It's Central Time at WPR.
Well, Eldar, getting back to you now, I mentioned usually not for the better. Are there times when scarcity, like in a deadline situation, can actually make us accomplish more?
Indeed. One thing that happens when you experience scarcity and you focus is that you do quite well on the thing on which you're focusing. So, you know, the poor who often neglect things and make errors do very well on the very specific thing they're handling right now. You know, they use their dollar better than those who live with plenty. They're very efficient. They know trade-offs. They know the prices of items in the supermarket they just bought, as opposed to the more wealthy who tend to neglect and not quite know all these things. So, in fact, when people focus on the thing they don't have enough of, whether it's time management or money, they do very well locally. But they leave less mind for other things, and often that comes back to haunt them when errors happen on the periphery.
Are there ways we can use this knowledge in our personal lives and say, I know I'm focusing on scarcity, I need to break out of that to do this other thing that's outside of that scarcity tunnel?
Indeed, or more even thinking about bandwidth more generally. So, you know, when I was waiting to talk to you and I had a few minutes free, I've learned not to check my email. Because in that email, there's going to be one message that distresses me or worries me, reminds me of a deadline I've missed. And I'm going to think about that, and part of my mind while talking to you is going to be spent on an email, and it's a mistake. So thinking about your bandwidth management in some sense, not distracting yourself with things that may as well wait when you're doing something important, arranging your day so that the things that require more mind happen early and things that require less mind happen in the moments when you plan to be distracted. leaving some slack throughout the day to catch up and manage things you hadn't anticipated. Those are all ways that, you know, when you develop intuition, make your management of the day a lot more easy if time is a scarce resource.
Can you talk more about the idea of slack? That's something you explore in your book, and you just mentioned in terms of time there.
Yeah, so the general notion of slack, you know, we use this metaphor of a suitcase. You know, some people travel with a very small, tightly packed suitcase. The things you need barely fit, and that creates a lot of difficulties. Anytime you want to add anything, you know, you buy a pair of shoes you like, you have to decide what to take out of the suitcase to make room for this new pair of shoes. When you have a larger suitcase with slack in it, life is a lot easier because you can just put things in that you hadn't planned because there's slack in your suitcase. You can move things around. You don't have to pack as carefully. And that has a lot of implications for everyday life. When you have some slack, it allows you to manage the unexpected. It allows you to pay less attention to how you pack your stuff throughout the day. When you're very, very busy and you commit to a lot of stuff, you have no slack. One meeting that goes late, one unanticipated traffic jam, and your entire schedule for the day is derailed, requiring more attention, more bandwidth, and leading you to forget, you know, picking up the kids from school, the car that's in the parking meter, or whatever else happens. They just can't, you know, have enough bandwidth at that moment.
And how can we prioritize a long-term versus a short-term solution? I'll give a personal example. Work, like many people, there's a time crunch.
Mm-hmm.
I know if I cleaned my desk every day, I'd have a benefit from that, and I'd actually have a little more time because I'm not digging through things on the desk. But it never seems like there's that time for it now. How can someone like me rechannel, take the effort up front to do that long-term payoff and put off that short-term stuff? Or is that possible?
That's a big challenge. I mean, you know, I think being aware of it and being smart about it and realizing the limitations that we encounter every day, you know, the way our mental machinery works, it's not always completely intuitive, is a big step. And then in the book, we propose some, you know, general strategies. So, for example, things that you can do once that will take care of a recurring problem. You know, you want to go to the exercise, you want to go to the gym twice a week, and it's not happening. One phone call to a trainer who waits for you from now on Tuesday and Thursday is a big step. You might still miss a few, but the stress to be there when somebody's sitting there waiting is, you know, very different from just planning to go there on your own. Committing to automatic deductions, committing to, you know, automatic small transfers from checking to long-term savings, anything you can do once to take care of a commitment for the long term is a big facilitator and, you know, opens bandwidth for other things. The cleaning the office is a classic example of where, you know, when you have too much imposing at you at the moment, things that are less critical tend to wait. You know, you're constantly fighting fires, and things that are not so burning, as it were, just wait for another time. And so we end up, you know, not getting our medical exams on time, not writing our wills when we should, you know, things like that. They always seem to have another day they can wait for, as opposed to the small stuff that needs to be done now, even if sometimes it's less important in the long run.
Well, again, earlier in the discussion, we talked about how public policy might deal with this in terms of poverty and having default decisions, scheduled payments instead of random ones.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other public policy take-homes from what you're talking about that we could have these default decisions and spare us some bandwidth?
Yeah, so, you know, the general idea is, again, it depends, of course, on who's the population, who you're dealing with, what the problem is. But the awareness of bandwidth is really interesting. So think about, you know, offering some benefits program for, you know, low-income workers. If you offer somebody, for example, food stamps, it would never occur to you to charge them $200 to join the program. I mean, that's exactly what they don't have. You're not going to charge them money for it. Now, what about bandwidth? You know, these people come to you money poor, but also bandwidth poor. What can we do to charge less bandwidth? When we present them with 15, you know, menacing pages of complicated language, lots of, you know, signing needing and under penalty of perjury if you're presented anything, that's a massive bandwidth tax. If there were ways to facilitate all that, they could make a big difference. And in fact, some recent studies have shown if you take FAFSA, for example, it's a benefit for going to college. You take people who know they're eligible and you compare their tendency to apply and matriculate to those who have the same form, but now somebody helps them fill out the form. You know, just literally sit with them and fill it out. That ends up increasing matriculation in college by 30 to 40%. That's a very cheap way to increase college attendance, just filling out somebody's form. And it's not intuitive unless you realize that for somebody who's bandwidth limited, filling out that 12 or 15 page form is a massive imposition. You know, they don't say, I won't do it, but they say, you know, some other time, you know, the same day you clean the office, that's when they'll apply to college. And years go by.
You also, in your book, talk some about the business world and some of the applications here. What could a business owner or manager take from your book and maybe get better performance out of employees?
Well, everything from controlling the management of time to the management of bandwidth, and in some cases even the management of money or social connections. So you basically, what you want to do if you're managing a company or a business is decide what are the sources of scarcity that impose on your workers, on your people's bandwidth the most, and how you could facilitate it. It might be childcare. Some people spend an inordinate amount of time worrying, who's going to take care of my kid tomorrow when I have to work an evening shift? That concern, that juggling of who's going to take care of the child every day, is a massive bandwidth imposition. You institute an easier, more friendly childcare arrangement, and all of a sudden you've liberated a lot of bandwidth for people to attend to things that might matter, to you and to the business a lot more. Reminders, secretaries who come in and announce the meeting is over, arranging meetings at the right times when people are not too preoccupied by things that happened 10 minutes earlier, imposing some slack, time that's built into your schedule where you just sit down and catch up on things that you have planned badly and have fallen on the wayside. All these kind of increase productivity. There's some evidence that actually make workers work fewer hours and do better.
Well, Eldar, thank you so much for spending your time and your bandwidth with us today.
It was a pleasure.
That was Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much.